This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joe Cohen from the City University of New York, Queens College.
I'm Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University.
And I'm Gabriel Rossman at University of California and a lot of DayQuil.
Our guest is Cristobal Young from Cornell University.
Hi there.
Hi, Cristobal.
Today, Cristobal Young on Millionaire Tax Flight. Our discussion was recorded on Wednesday, April 17th, 2019. And now we turn to Cristobal Young from Cornell University. Cristobal wrote The Myth of the Millionaire Tax Flight, How Place Still Matters for the Rich with Stanford University Press. In my opinion, it's one of the best empirical findings to come out of our discipline in the past few years. So congratulations, Cristobal.
Thanks.
It's a pleasure to have you on.
No, it's a pleasure to be here. It's great to be here with you guys.
The Myth of the Millionaire Tax Flight, what's the book about?
Well, you know, the name gives away some of the content, but the basic idea is sort of what happens when you tax the rich. And there's lots of political opinions floating around out there, but not a lot of informed views. People don't. But basic idea is elite income earners are often sort of seen as a kind of transnational capitalist class, moving seamlessly throughout the world through networks of global cities, living largely free of rules and laws of places, states, and nations. Mm-hmm. And so in this idea, the rich have gone global, and especially if you tax them, they will leave. And this sounds true, but is that really the world that we're living in? Mm-hmm. So the kind of question I'm thinking about, like, really, what is the connection between elites and the places where they live? Is place like a temporary convenience for the rich, sort of easily switched out when the tides change? Or is place like a deep foundation for the elite's social and economic prosperity? Mm. You know, are top income earners mobile millionaires, or are they embedded elites? Okay, so tough question to take on because we don't have very much data on these folks. They're top coded in the census, like their incomes are too high. It's sort of it's going to reveal things if we report them. So can't really see them in the census. They don't really like to participate in interviews, so that might be more possible than we realized. Mm. But anyway, they have to file their tax returns, and that's the data, you know, I draw on. So I'm looking at administrative tax data on every $1 million income earner in the U.S. over more than a decade.
Nice.
That's 45 million tax records on where millionaires live and where they move to over the long term. Mm. Uh-huh.
That's amazing. Just having that data, dude, is just amazing. But go on.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's you know, it's challenging data to work with. It's difficult data to access, and it took a long time to cultivate that access. But I really think it's been valuable because, well, I mean, you can learn so much, and it just has so much credibility in this day where we're so polarized on questions like this, like what happens when you tax the rich? People are in their camps. But when you can step up and say, well, I looked at everybody's tax returns, and this is what you see in a really sort of simple analysis, you know, people stop and listen in a way that they don't necessarily do in political discourse these days.
Yeah, you know what, Cristobal, like in listening to you and in reading some of the book, like I think part of, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think part of the problem is the people who are putting forward these kinds of policies, they don't understand the distinction between space and place, right? Like space is like, okay, yeah, just move to New York just because, you know, we're going to give you these tax credits versus, you know, you're already in New York and you already love New York. Your family is from here. You're already embedded.
Yeah.
And like, right? So why should we offer you these tax incentives?
Yeah, there's definitely not a lot of sociological thinking going on in this idea of sort of hypermobility. Hmm. And maybe like a false analogy with travel, like travel is classic luxury good. Hmm. Uh-huh. And rich people do it all the time. But moving your home, your family, your life to another place is not a luxury good. It's not fun.
Yeah.
And it comes with a lot of costs, and you give up a lot of things, you know, your social networks, you know, is something that I really like to talk about. And, you know, I'm thinking here of an article, Gabriel Rossman titled "I'd Like to Thank the Academy," Team Spillovers, and Network Centrality. You know, and I think in our day-to-day lives, we don't often realize how much like our own productivity or our own like sort of being good at stuff is derived from the fact that we work with great people and people help us, and like we're all doing team production. If we think about just educating students, you know, as professors, you know, we educate students for like maybe one or two courses out of the 30 or 40 courses that they're going to take while they're an undergrad. And so, you know, we're really dependent. We're a great university because we have great colleagues. You know, it's not really about us. We're making a small incremental contribution. We're really drawing on like a big, broader team.
If I recall correctly, that's actually too conservative of a case, because you found that there's fairly minimal tax sensitivity among millionaires when states span labor markets. Like that you don't have people moving from Connecticut to Jersey or whichever way it would be, even though both.
Looking at like the border county regions.
Exactly. Because if it's just about, you know, team production at work. Right now, that's not true in California, where all of our major population centers are hundreds of miles of wilderness from a state line. But in you know, New York City, Washington D.C., you know, Chicago, there's plenty of places where Philadelphia, like most of the metropolitan areas, especially in the East Coast and in the Midwest, are right on a state line. So you actually do have a certain amount of tax jurisdiction shopping that's theoretically possible while still remaining in the same labor market.
It could be possible while being in the same area. Places like, you know, New York and Connecticut, you know, it's like if you drive the tunnel, you're in a different state, essentially. You can be in Connecticut or New Jersey wouldn't be a tax advantage, but Connecticut would be. And to the extent that we see any tax migration, it's really about Florida. It's not about just, you know, there's many places. Virginia and Tennessee, there's places where you can cross the street and be in a different tax jurisdiction and have a very different tax rate, and people just don't do it. Oregon and Washington, you know, in Portland, Oregon, Oregon's for generations had the highest tax, one of the highest tax rates in the country, and Washington State doesn't have a state income tax system. You know, you'd think that if people really cared about this tax rate, the tax rate they're paying, they would find a way to move their lives over, you know, across the Columbia River, across the bridge here in Washington State. You're still part of Portland Metro, but you're in that different tax jurisdiction and you just don't see it. The rich people overwhelmingly live on the Portland, Oregon side, where they pay the high income tax, not the Washington side. So maybe I'll just unfold the basics. Here, you know, I try to do this, particularly in the book, tried to write this for a broad audience and just sort of unfold the analysis in like sort of three simple questions. So first, thinking about, you know, are the rich moving to avoid taxes? Okay, so the first question is, well, just millionaire population. Let's take a step back and think about face validity. Millionaire population, millionaires per capita, is just unrelated to the top state, this top state tax rate in the U.S. today. So millionaires are equally likely to live in high tax states as in low tax states. You know, so a simple way of thinking about this is, you know, California, New York, for, you know, 50 or 80 years have had the highest tax rates in the country, and yet still here they are as the centers of American capitalism, as centers of elite income earning and opportunity in the U.S. So it's just sort of like simple face validity. Wow, if people are really moving a lot to avoid taxes, how do we account for this? Second, you know, are millionaires especially mobile? And the answer, as I alluded to, is like, no, they're not. Migration is not like travel. It's a totally different thing. The most mobile people in the country are low income earners who are moving across state lines as part of sort of a survival strategy, or like, or trying to make it, trying to make their place in the economic world. And rich people have like half the migration rate of poor people. So millionaires in the tax data, their cross state migration rate, the chance that they move across state lines in any given year is 2.4%. For the poor, it's almost 5%. So,
well, and my understanding is most of those very high income earners run businesses. And so to relocate them personally, like they're active business managers too. So relocation could also involve relocating an entire business, which is impractical.
Yeah, that's right. So they are much more likely to own a business and have business income than the general population. You know, I think the broadest characterization is that they're sort of the late career working rich.
Yeah.
So a lot of professionals, that's finance, business consulting, but law, medicine as well. But yeah, people who are working, they have careers, they have businesses that they own, they have colleagues, collaborators, investors, clients, you know, people, you know, so their social network is really important to how the people that work for them are really important, and they can't just pick up and move. You know, you can't take your social capital with you when you move. You can't just say to your clients like, ah, I'm moving to Florida to save money on my taxes.
Yeah.
So let's go, everyone. You know, that's just not how it works.
I'm going to mine for gold in New York City instead of...
Right.
So with this issue you mentioned about lower income people, it got me thinking because, like, you do see net domestic migration out of high tax states into low tax states. So, for instance, California has very high net domestic out migration.
Yeah.
The only reason that California's population continues to grow is because we also have high international migration to California.
And natural population growth. But yeah, that's right. People, you know, California is seeing significant net out migration, but that's among, you know, lower income and middle class folks.
Which is interesting, right? Because we have a highly progressive state income tax.
Yeah, but it's not tax driven, though. My understanding is it's cost of living driven. Yeah.
Well, that's my point, right? And you do see businesses relocating. So, for instance, Nissan of USA and Toyota of USA both used to be based in Los Angeles, and they moved respectively to Tennessee and Texas. And took all the jobs with them.
Both low tax states.
Yeah, but those are lower tax states. But my understanding is that the reason they moved wasn't because they were lower tax states. Some of it may be because they had more favorable regulation, but most of it is just that the cost of living is so much lower that in order to pay people in California, you have to pay them so they can afford California rent.
Yeah, you know, this is a great point. And you occasionally see like the governor of Texas or Florida saying like, hey, we're open for business, come move here because of our tax rate. And that's not true. That's not why people are moving for the most part. And so I wish that they would actually be more productive and say like, hey, come and look at our land use policies. We're open for business because we let people build, you know, we're building housing for the people here in Texas.
So in Crystal Utopia, which sounds a lot like Gabriel Utopia, you might have relatively high state income tax, but you're going to have very lax land use restrictions.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree on it. I mean, it's ridiculous. If I moved to California today, I mean, I wouldn't be able to buy like a town. You know, we sold our townhouse of more than double what we bought it for, you know, 6 years prior. It's just absurd. People are just being priced out.
I bought a house in 2009 and sold it in 2015, and it went up by like 30 or 40%, and since then it's gone up by like another 40%. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it didn't used to be like this. You know, there's a study looking at global housing prices in major cities around the world from 1870 to 1970. Over that century, there's essentially no net trend in housing prices. And since 1970, all around the world, housing prices are skyrocketing. Like something is broken about housing markets today. And California is a great reflection of that. And New York is as well. And
some
of these high tax states there's something correlated there.
Right. But the point is that like it's not the tax system that's driving migration, and the migration certainly doesn't involve wealthy people. So when we're told that we have to keep our taxes down because millionaires are going to move away, or you know, successful business people are going to leave, it's just not. It seems like it's an empty threat. That's what you're finding them part.
Yeah, and that is true what you're saying, that it's – so if you look at the California statistics, the only educational group that has net domestic in-migration is people with graduate degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And the only income group that has net domestic in-migration is the top income quintile.
Yeah, exactly.
So basically California is losing the moderately educated and the poorly educated natives,
mm-hmm.
and it's losing – middle and lower income natives, but it's gaining the upper class. So, I mean, all of this is combining to make to send the Gini coefficient of California through the roof.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that one of the reasons why? I mean, I don't live there, but, you know, I try and stay on top of it. But isn't that one of the reasons why, like, your governor was just like, I'm actually pretty cool with, like, you know, like, and that, like having these taxes or having these, you know, these kinds of costs, right?
The emerging fight that you see in California is the state is gradually favoring more density and localities still oppose it because it's kind of a collective action problem. It's in the interest of any given locality to oppose density, both because residents increase demand for services and also because you know, there's congestion costs, like people want low traffic and ample parking.
Yeah, you need infrastructure to handle a growing population that requires investment.
Yeah, exactly. And but at the so it's rational for any given locality, like municipality, to want to remain low density. But the problem is that if every locality remained low density, then at the labor market level, it drives rents through the roof.
It's self-interested. I don't know if it's rational. I mean, does New York City regret becoming New York City? I don't think so. But you know, if residents of New York in like 1920 could have blocked growth, they probably would have been happy with themselves about that. But so I don't think it's rational, but it's definitely self-interested, if you get that distinction. Do you agree?
It's rational for the actors who have the property, but it's self-interested, but it's not necessarily the best course of action for the community in the aggregate. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
I think for the Los Angeles metropolitan statistical area, keeping density low is completely insane. I think for any given municipality within the Los Angeles metropolitan statistical area, or even more so the San Jose, San Francisco consolidated metropolitan statistical area, it makes a lot of sense for Mountain View to want to remain not dense, right? Because one thing that remaining very low density does is it means that you only have rich people living there, right? You have to be extraordinarily wealthy to buy a house in Mountain View.
Yeah.
Because a house that, and what's absurd is, like, if you visit Silicon Valley, you look at it and you're like, this is the house that costs $5 million? It looks like the house I grew up in.
Yeah.
In suburbia.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a 1200 square foot ranch house that costs $5 million because it's half a mile from Google.
Yeah.
And so if you keep the density low, you're ensuring that only rich people can live there, which means that, you know, you have to spend less on services. You have a better tax base. You know, you don't have to spend more on the public schools because you have fewer kids going and they're kids who are easier to educate. So yeah, I think it actually does make rational sense for a municipality to stay low density, even though it's insane for a region to stay low density.
Yeah. And I mean, for the people, I actually totally want to call out homeowners in California.
Yeah.
I think more people need to seriously reflect on this. Is that, like, if you owned a home in Mountain View, you know, 15 years ago, your net wealth has exploded for something that has nothing to do with you. It's because Google became extremely successful and has pushed up housing prices, and resisting any building, you're protecting, you know, your two-bedroom townhouse that now sells for $1.2 million when, you know, you bought it for $60,000. But, you know, you're also making it extremely difficult for young people for them to have a chance to live in California, for them to get a piece of the California dream. You're basically locking out young people from, you know, from what you had, from the opportunity you had.
Even on a self-interested level like that, in an intergenerational sense, like, that means your kids will move away because your kids can't afford to live in your community. Like, there are, in a dollars and cents conception of well-being, it might make sense to sort of defend your, defend your artificially inflated properties. But in a wider holistic sense, I don't know if it's altogether great. And you know what? Again, that's what I like about this study, that it speaks to. It's like, you see, even the rich, their lives are not centered on maximizing dollars. Like, there's a richer conception of well-being that explains, or people's own conception of their life choices.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really nice reminder, like, this book, in terms of that. Like, maybe we fetishize money. It's measurable. It's easy to track. But when we're talking about why people make their choices, there's a lot more than money at work.
Is it that we fetishize money, or is it that, like, we have this, like, really kind of twisted vision of what rich people are like.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Like they got, I mean, they all use the bathroom. They got to eat. Yeah. They got families. Yeah. They love America. They love American apple pie. I mean, like whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that for me comes out of this research is, you know, rich people are people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're kind of like, you know, you or I, just with a lot more money.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, it's funny. I was just having this conversation with someone else, but about beauty, right? And I was like, beautiful people are people too. They're just crazy good looking.
Are they really though?
Well, it's a resource that you can mobilize, right? And in some ways, it's probably more advantageous to be beautiful than rich in a lot of sort of life goals that people have for themselves.
Depending on the context, yeah, and what you want, exactly.
And what you're trying to get.
These things do change people, right? Like, you know, the longer you're rich, the more, you know, your stance towards the world is going to change. And I think that's probably true for physical attractiveness as well. But have you guys had Debbie Becker on the program?
No.
You know, her cousin is Larry Page of PageRank fame. That's Google, right? Mm. And so I sometimes talk to her. Like, they still spend time together. And they, you know, he takes them all to some Caribbean island for Christmas vacation or winter vacation, whatever. And she's like, yeah, it's changed him a lot. But, you know, we still get along great. We're still cousins, you know.
Interesting.
But and I don't want to leave it on the table like, oh, rich people are just people. There's nothing different. Like, of course, these things change people. But Larry Page still lives in California. He lives in the place where he went to grad school. He lives just down the street from his company. You know, he's not like some global billionaire who's jet setting, you know, and living in some offshore tax haven. You know, he's living a lot like, you know, he did when he was in grad school in some ways.
I mean, look at Donald Trump, right? I'm just saying, look at Donald Trump, right? Like, so Donald Trump is like, okay, I'm gonna like go to Atlantic City and I'm gonna fail. And I'm gonna be in New York and fail, but I'm never gonna leave New York. You know what I mean? It's like, this is my rock. And being part of New York is not just part of who he is, but it's also part of how he markets whatever it is he's trying to market, right? And there's no way Donald Trump is gonna move like his whatever Trump enterprise or whatever from there to I don't know, Ogallala, Nebraska, right?
It wouldn't be good for the brand.
but he plays this game like that would possibly happen. And I think that that's one of the things about your book is that like it's won't possibly happen, right? So why give, you know, rather than just speculating that this is going to happen, like why not just actually see and just say, okay, fine, the millionaires and billionaires who want to stay, good, and the ones who don't, like all of this is going to sort itself out, right? But it will probably be like a net of zero. Like you won't really lose anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, personally, I think all of these are empirical questions, but I think, you know, blue states should, the policy implication here for me is that blue states should be much more comfortable with the idea of competing against red state policy regimes. Like blue states that like invest a lot in people and education, childcare, infrastructure, quality of life. The idea that they're not competitive with red states because red states have low taxes, low cost of living, less government. You know, I mean, you can't really look out at America and say like, oh yeah, red states that are just like cut taxes and get out of your way have it so much better. That's just not true, you know. And New York and California, I think, should be states that are like, you know, we're championing a blue state model and we're ongoing policy experiments, but, you know, we're doing great. And there should be more confidence in sort of stepping up and saying like, no, we are going to continue to be a laboratory for policy in this country and experiment with things like how can we provide a more affordable healthcare for more people? And these kinds of things, and not just sit back and be scared every time somebody says, oh, but the rich are going to leave, you know, because they're not leaving. You know, the rich are, they're embedded elites. They're very grounded in their communities.
So I got the impression when you started working on this that, you know, the policy debate was very much on, should we raise the state income tax in California or Connecticut or Jersey or whatever?
Jersey, yeah.
And it's funny because since you've done it, Congress capped the state and local tax deduction.
Yep.
And there's been some very interesting politics of that.
Yeah.
Where blue state politicians, their reaction has been to refer to this as a horrifying tax hike.
Well, Andrew Cuomo, let's be clear. Andrew Cuomo has done
it. No, not just Andrew Cuomo. We get plenty of this in California. California politicians do it. And also the Center for American Progress loves to refer to this as a tax hike on middle-class families. Whereas if you look at it, the actual incidence of the SALT cap, it only really affects people earning over $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
And most of it affects people earning around $500,000 a year. But for anyone earning less than $100,000, basically nobody got a tax hike because of the SALT cap. It's all for basically top quintile earners.
Yeah.
But so it's not a middle class issue. It's an upper middle class and upper class issue.
Yeah. It's like a blue state. It's a tax on like high income people in blue states, essentially.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Or to put it another way, it's partially revoking a previous tax expenditure.
Yeah.
That, you know, took some of the blue state taxes out of federal taxes. But so, you know, here you kind of have it on the other foot where it's like you have a bunch of blue state politicians who sound like Grover Norquist.
All of a sudden, yeah.
You know, complaining about taxes on the rich, although they won't admit that they're taxes on the rich. They pretend that this is a tax on the blue state middle class, which it really isn't. So I don't know. It's just funny how the kind of politics of that have flipped. And one implication of your research is that we wouldn't see big impacts in terms of people moving between jurisdictions or that sort of thing of Congress capping the SALT and local tax deduction.
Absolutely. The funny thing, so, you know, my first study on this was looking at New Jersey. We used the New Jersey state income tax data and published a study of it. And, you know, Chris Christie came into office, you know, and maybe his single biggest issue was rolling back the millionaire tax in New Jersey. And we were just a big pain in the ass for him. Well, our study was a big pain in the ass for him, but he was just constantly delivering speeches again and talking about our study like, oh, you know, these professors, they're interested in things that are theoretical, but guys like me got to deal with what's real, you know. And he's talking about like, I'm using the tax return data to show that people didn't move out of New Jersey after they passed the millionaire's tax. And he's spinning nothing, you know?
Yeah, ironically, he was relying on theory and you were relying on data.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Exactly, exactly. But today it's like Governor Cuomo of New York sounds just like Chris Christie. It's like, hold on, is this Chris Christie again? No, it's Governor Cuomo. And he's also talking, he's got nothing. You know, he's been like, oh, this is going to kill New York and rich people are going to leave. They just can't take it anymore. They're leaving and we got to do something about this. And like the rare journalist who will say, who will recognize that that's an empirical claim, will say, well, what's that based on? He's like, anecdotal evidence. You got nothing. You have no evidence.
Well, it seems like the best way to understand it is that whether it's Christie trying to lower taxes or Cuomo trying to somehow find an insane workaround where you donate money to the state, but that's not a tax or whatever.
Yeah.
So that they can effectively restore the SALT and or engage in a massive amount of litigation with the IRS.
Yeah.
You know, that in both cases, it's politicians trying to help local elites.
Yes, exactly.
They may sincerely believe that it's going to create problems for the state, but really, it's almost more of a rent-seeking issue.
Yeah, yeah. They're trying to signal to elites that, like, I'm here for you. You know, I'm trying to stand up for you, rich people. You know, and basically in the Citizens United era, where, you know, being a politician means having to constantly fundraise. Mm. So yeah, I think talking about millionaire migration for like state level politicians is just, you know, a really nice way to just sort of put up a flag and just sort of convey to, you know, high income earners in the state, like, I'm concerned about you. I'm trying to look out for you. It's sort of like a signaling mechanism in a fundraising game, basically. But anyway, you know, empirical question is, are rich people going to move to Florida or Texas or Tennessee because of the Trump tax bill? And so I've got an MOU with IRS to study this. And, you know, maybe this time next year we'll have some results. But, you know, high income earners never file their taxes, basically never file their taxes on tax day. They file a 6-month extension that anyone can file. Any of us can file this. It's costless to do so. And they have very complicated tax returns. So they haven't filed their tax returns yet. We don't know where they, we don't know what address they're going to be filing their tax returns from. And we won't know that. The data won't start trickling in for another 6 months, and then we'll get to analyze it.
But here's the thing, Cristobal, right? I mean, it's like we learn, like you learn this in Econ 101, right? I mean, they're very simplistic about it, but like, you know, we all have our like bags of goods, right? That are like suited towards our needs and our wants, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things about being rich, right? And I think maybe that means we need to be a little bit more careful about how we like conceptualize and operationalize what it means to be rich in America is one of the things about being rich is actually you can choose to say, okay, fine, I'll pay extra for taxes so I can be in this place, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things. It's like there isn't just this aversion to being billed for things. There is also this kind of willingness to say, okay, fine, sure, I will pay extra because you know what, in terms of marginal costs, like it doesn't hit me as much as it does other people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I mean, rich people live in very expensive neighborhoods, and the idea that like their willingness to pay to live in a great place ends at their driveway, I think doesn't make sense. You know, places like New York City are just expensive. Like it requires a lot of resources to keep that city running. You know, LA, same thing. And it's worth it. Like they're great cities, and you know, there's a lot of opportunity in those cities. And the idea that it's like, well, but there's a tax bill, so I don't want to pay that. If you just make a simple analogy to like everyday living expenses, rich people are willing to pay to be in great places.
Yes. This makes me think of Josh McCabe's argument about red states not having much just because they can't afford it. Like they're poor. It's not like they have to seek this low tax, low regulation sort of strategy because they're poor.
Right.
They're like they are to the coast as like Mexico is to the United States in an economic sense. And that's just the niche they got to fill.
Many red states, that's true, yeah.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. A special thank you to Cristobal Young from Cornell. His book is The Myth of Millionaire Tax Flight, How Place Still Matters for the Rich, with Stanford University Press. We're on the web, sociocast.org/annex, on Twitter @SociAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. On behalf of Leslie Hinkson and Gabriel Rossman, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.